Today is Friday, April 6th, 2007. My name is Sandy Fahler, and I'm an interviewer with the University of Wisconsin-Madison Oral History Project. Today I am interviewing Dr. Grace Waba, I.J. Schoenberg Hilldale Professor of Statistics and Professor of Biostatistics and Medical Informatics in the UW-Madison College of Letters and Science Department of Statistics. She holds an affiliate faculty appointment in the Department of Computer Sciences. Hello, Grace.
Hi.
We're going to start the interview by asking you to talk about where and when you were born. If you would talk about your childhood, your early schooling, talk about any family members, teachers, or others who encouraged you in your studies.
Oh, well, I was born in Washington, D.C., August 3rd, 1934. Don't tell anybody, so I'll be 73 years old. Still going strong, and I have no plans to retire anytime soon. My father was a patent attorney. We lived in Washington, D.C. My mother had a bachelor's degree in fine arts at the time, so my parents were educated. My father was very interested in science, and he wanted to be a chemist. But when he graduated during the Depression, his professors told him that there was no future in chemistry, so he went to law school and became a patent attorney. But I think he always wanted to be a scientist. And I sort of grew up with the idea that being a scientist was a good thing.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, so I have a brother that's 4 years younger than I am. He's been his career in the Foreign Service, and he lives in Taiwan now, married a Taiwanese woman, and I have a very interracial family, actually. His wife is Chinese, and I have a Chinese niece and nephew with my brother. And I have a sister who's a very talented artist who's 10 years younger than I am, lives in New Mexico. Let's see, I wrote down a few things here.
Where did you go to elementary school?
I went to elementary school in Washington, and then during the Second World War, the patent office moved to Richmond, Virginia, and so we moved to Richmond, and then my father left the patent office, and we moved to Jamaica, New York, where he became the patent attorney for a German manufacturing company that the U.S. government had taken over during the war. And then we moved back to Washington, and then I went to high school in Montclair, New Jersey, where Dad became the patent attorney for Huffman LaRoche. So now he was next to a laboratory. I think he really liked that. His friends were all patent attorneys or chemists. And so he used to come home and tell me about his work. I was really enthralled by hearing stories of what was going on in the laboratory. And in fact, when I was later years in high school, and I think I was a freshman in college, where he was involved in patenting the first tranquilizer, which was the Rolofia root, which his company had isolated the active ingredient to become Serpacil, which was the first tranquilizer. And there was a big patent interference case, and my father litigated that case and won, and it was a big deal. And I learned all about how scientists keep lab notebooks and the process of discovery and so forth.
Now, the high school that you went to, that was a public high school?
Yeah,
Was it a good school?
Yeah, it was a good school, Montclair, New Jersey. Well, it was the only school in Montclair. And Montclair had the right side of the tracks and the wrong side of the tracks. And we were one of the few Jewish families that lived in Upper Montclair, actually. In those days, there were still housing covenants, and it was quite rare for Jewish families to be in that part of town. But we were. And the high school was strictly segregated, and that all of the kids from Upper Montclair were all in college preparation classes, and all the kids from the wrong side of the tracks were not in college prep classes, but that's the way it was in those days. And I was going back a little bit to ninth grade, where I had an out which was in junior high in Upper Montclair, where I had an algebra teacher who gave us algebra proofs. And I would stay up all night making sure I got the proofs right. I remember my mother trying to get me to go to sleep when I wasn't going to go to bed until I got those proofs.
So you were a good student.
I was a good student, yeah. I was very determined to get the math right. And then when I got to high school, there was something that we really don't have anymore. There was a class of only 5 students that Mr. Leach, one of the teachers, gave to 5 students that he invited. We studied probability in our senior year, just the 5 of us. And that was a wonderful class. And then I was the only girl in the physics class, and I used to sit up front. And in the back, there were 4 young men that were always harassing the teacher. The teacher was an old person who would drop the chalk and take the watch off his right hand and put his left hand in the water tank and things like that. And the guys in the back would give him a hard time. And I'd sit there and say, try to pay attention to what was going on and go home and I'd do my physics homework. And my father had saved his physics book from when he was in high school, and he gave me his physics lab notebooks because I didn't understand them. Mm-hmm. But what I did understand was that he was proud of his daughter who was doing physics.
Right.
All right, 50 years later, we have a high school reunion, and people started writing to one another. And those 4 guys who used to sit in the back and harass the teacher, Mr. Leach, they had formed Mr. Leach's physics club, and they had been friends for 50 years.
Oh, no.
And one of them wrote me and said, well, you were the only one that understood per second, that's acceleration. I didn't understand it then, but anyway. And he said,
we all hated you.
Anyway, we had a fun correspondence, and it turned out that some of them actually became engineers when they, 50 years later, they were telling me about it. So I had Mr. Leach and the math teacher and a physics teacher in high school, and I was probably considered a nerd, but that's the way it was.
How did you decide where to go to college?
Oh, well, that was easy. I was going out with some boy who was going to Cornell, and the original plan was, I had always had a fondness in my heart for Washington, so I applied to all the schools in Washington. And then we visited Washington. My parents are both graduated from George Washington University, and they didn't have much of a campus. I wasn't really impressed. And the University of Maryland, I was admitted to University of Maryland, but they didn't have room in the dorms. And my uncle knew the provost there or something and offered to intercede with me to get a room in the dorms. But I decided I didn't want to go someplace that took special privileges to get in. And then, surprise, surprise, I got admitted to Cornell, even though I didn't have very good grades in high school, except for the math and physics. I just made sure that I just barely cracked a B, because it was very, you probably know, it was very unfashionable for girls to be too smart.
True.
Well, I wasn't going to give up the math and physics, but I decided I'm not going to shine in history, English, all that other stuff. So I had all Bs. My French teacher gave me a C and a little A sitting there in math and physics. And the French teacher was also the guidance counselor, said, you'll never get into Cornell with that C. She was really nasty. She says, don't bother, don't waste your money applying. But anyway, I did. I got in, and it was extremely lucky because, although I didn't realize it, and that was one of the few places that women could really study mathematics under world-famous teachers. Because the Ivy League, only Brown was the only other Ivy school that let in women. You know, Harvard, Princeton, Yale, Colgate, Dartmouth, women, they didn't admit women. So anyway, I went to Cornell.
And what did you major in then?
Well, I started out in math, and when I was growing up, I thought, I want a real career, whatever it is, I want a real career. I just want a real career. And I thought, well, engineering, you get an engineering degree, you have to have a real career with that. I didn't know anything about math. I thought math was wonderful, but I didn't know you could earn a living with math. So I thought, I'll go to Cornell. If I do well, they say engineering is very hard. So if I do well, then I'll transfer into engineering. Well, I didn't really think I was doing very well, and I wasn't doing particularly well, except that because of this probability class in high school, I did not take trigonometry, which is a high school math course. So I took trigonometry my freshman year, and I saw Professor Rosser, and that's another story about Professor Rosser. Professor Rosser said, you better take calculus along with the trigonometry, because otherwise you'll be behind everyone. So I took calculus and trigonometry, and I got extremely high grades in both of them. I made the dean's list, and at the last minute, I was very surprised I made the dean's list. So I thought, I'm going to be an engineer. Well, I know I missed all the engineering orientation. I had no idea. There are 5 engineering schools. There was a woman in civil engineering. She said, Grace, you got to go into civil. Well, I went into civil, and that woman, Vita Frankel, she left 2 weeks later. That left me the only woman in engineering school.
And no faculty, no women faculty.
No women faculty, no. And, well, to make a long story short, I decided that I really didn't want to be a civil engineer. And there's another 50-year story about that. I went to my 50th college reunion this year, 50 years, and I ran into some of my old buddies in civil engineering. And they said, you know, they were so relieved when you left CE because they would have had to create a special ladies' room for you if you had gone to summer camp. And some of the faculty were grumbling that it was a big waste of money. And I didn't really know this. Or maybe I subconsciously knew it. But anyway, I transferred back into letters and sciences and eventually got a bachelor's degree in math.
So, and what happened then?
Well, let's see, there are 2 things. First of all, due to doing wonderfully in calculus the first semester, I got into Professor Mark Katz's special calculus class. There were only 13 of us, so we were treated really well.
And were you the only female?
I'm trying to remember now. There was one other woman math student, Diane Feingold. And I know we used to go in and see Professor Katz together for advising, but I don't think she was in that class. But I saw a couple of people in the 50-year reunion that were, one person that was. But anyway, so jumping back and forth, I mentioned 2 people, Professor Ross and Professor Katz, from my undergraduate days. Mm-hmm. 25 years ago, Professor Katz was invited here as the Hilldale speaker, and I was his hostess. I was asked to be his hostess. That was wonderful. He had this thick Polish accent. He said, "Well, Grace, I would have never known." I can't imitate his accent. He said, "I would have never known that you would be the most famous member of that class."
Wow.
Knocked me over. Anyway, and the other Professor Rosser I mentioned, Professor Katz was my undergraduate advisor, but my senior year I was pregnant, and that's another long story, which I'll probably omit. But I went in, so Professor Katz was on leave, so somebody said, "Well, you have to get Professor Rosser as an advisor because he's very famous." And so I went in to see Professor Rosser, and he had, I don't quite know how to describe it then, but I can still remember it was sort of expressionless. And I said, "Well, Professor Rosser, I have to drop some of these more difficult classes. I have to drop physics because I can't do the lab. I'm pregnant, going to be pregnant. And so I just want to take probability and nothing else." And he just signed the form, and that was it. I didn't see him again until I came to Madison. He was here in Madison. He was head of the, he was in the math department. And I don't think he remembered me from undergraduate days. I remembered him. But he was so charming. And his wife, Annetta Rosser, is a lovely woman. Professor Rosser passed away 10 or 12 years ago. Mm-hmm. There's a, the family endowed the Rosser Lectures in Computer Science. Oh. And so I always go to them, and I see Mrs. Rosser, who's 92 now. But she used to throw lovely parties. She always had parties. I was at the Math Research Center before it was blown up. And so she had, she would entertain the mathematicians there. And so I have very fond memories of Professor Rosser and, as I say, Mrs. Rosser, who's still alive now, 92. She's 93. She was 92 last year. She comes to the lecture, and they introduce her, you know. That's very nice.
So you graduated with a degree?
So I graduated with a bachelor's degree, and my son, Jeffrey Wabba, was born 6 weeks later. And my second, my first husband, and I went to Washington, back to Washington. He was at National Institutes of Health as a postdoc. And so I had all this wonderful math, a bachelor's degree in math. I had 39 credit hours of math, I still remember, including the probability class was the graduate class. And I had a very dear girlfriend who lived in the same building, had a baby the same time I did, and we would trade babysitting. And so I wanted to get out of the house and she could look after Jeff. I would take turns looking after her, Cynthia. And I saw a teaching job, teaching junior high, and I called up and said, well, I have a bachelor's degree. I want to teach math, I'm a seventh grade math teacher. And I have a bachelor's degree and 39 hours of math, almost a first, the equivalent of close to a first year of graduate work. And she said, what kind of education courses do you have? And I said, well, I said, I'm really good in math. And I said, I taught calculus when I was a junior. They gave me a calculus class to teach it. So I taught calculus at college. And I think, you know, it would be a good stop. She says, we don't even send applications to people like you. No education. That hasn't changed.
No, I know.
That has not changed.
That's
right. And you know, I've been teaching here for umpteen years. The American students come here, and with a few exceptions, they have nowhere near the same math background that the students from China, India, Romania, Sri Lanka, Vietnam have better math backgrounds. It's bizarre. So, well, anyway.
Oh, you're right, though.
We all know
changed.
That teaching here, teaching science in the high schools is not a very attractive job.
Right.
And then there's no credit for having lots of advanced work in the field. You can't do it unless you have several years, you have at least 2 years of education courses. And so it's not an attractive thing.
Mm-hmm. So what did you do then?
Oh, well, let's see, where were we? Oh, all right,
you
so that was out,
yeah.
And then I thought about trying to go back to graduate school, and I looked into the University of Maryland, and they had the basic math course for first-year PhD students, or master's students, I guess, met at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Well, I'm trying to make a long story short here, but my son's father really didn't want me to go to graduate school. And when he was at NIH as a postdoc, and every afternoon at 5 o'clock, all of the wives would drive into the campus at NIH with the kids in the car, and they'd stand outside, and all the husbands would come out. Except for there were a few women there, actually. But mostly it was this big lineup of all these women all dolled up to meet their husbands, pick them up, and with the kids at 5 o'clock and take them home. And if I had taken that course, he would have had to carpool or take the bus home, and he wouldn't do it. So I couldn't do it. Well, after a while, but in the process, though, I had a lucky break in that the person I talked to at University of Maryland had also got his PhD at Cornell under Mark Katz. And he said, well, I'm sorry, you can't go to graduate school. He said, but I can give you a job teaching remedial math here at the university in the afternoon, early afternoon, if you want. So I took him. So my girlfriend, Priscilla, took care of Jack, and I taught business 001 or something. Taught people how to read pie charts and bar charts, basically. It's pretty remedial. Pretty basic. Anyway, I got out of the house, but a semester of that I realized this is not the direction that I want to take, and I lined up a full-time job with a company called Operations Research Incorporated, and my ex-husband went along with that because the postdoc didn't really pay very much and he liked the money. And in those days, Washington, D.C. was a very segregated city. We're talking about, this was in the late 50s, and so it was very easy to find nannies because black women had no other job opportunities than as domestic help. So I had found a nanny who looked after him, and I took up this job at Operations Research Incorporated, and I started out as a human computer. We didn't have electronic computers then in the late 50s. Mm-hmm. Well, we had, it was an electronic calculator. You wound it up. It had a handle and you wound it up and then you punched numbers in. And so I did numerical quadrature. And I did that for a couple months. And it was kind of boring, but it was mathematical in some sense, better than being a clerk. And I had a wonderful mentor there by the name of Ritz Heer, Robert R. Heer Jr. And and what happened was that I was doing mathematical work for the guys in the other room, the engineers. I knew more math than they did. And after a while, they would give me this stuff to do, and I'd say, you didn't set that up right. And I'd set it up for them. So that happened 3 or 4 times, when I could see that somebody was doing something really dumb, and I was going to have to spend a week punching numbers to get something that wasn't going to tell them what they wanted to know anyway. So after a few times of that, Ritz said, well, we're going to move you out of the back room and you can be a junior engineer, which I was. And he sort of taught me the business. I studied operations research on the side, and I started back to University of Maryland. They gave me I didn't start back to University of Maryland, actually, until my husband and I split. After 2 years at NIH, his postdoc ran out, and he went up to Boston, and I just said I wasn't going with him. And so I stayed there. I had a job. I had a babysitter. And I went back to Maryland this time and started graduate school.
And how was it what you expected?
Well, I had mentors all over the place. I mean, I just must have been lucky. First this professor's name I don't remember, who was a student of Mark Katz, and then there was George Weiss at Maryland, and Richard Siski, who was a Polish refugee, had just come, and he was in queuing theory, and he was really a very nice man and a mentor, and Marvin Zellen, who's a statistician, who to this day I see him every once in a while. And I took George Weiss's class, and then I did 2 years. It took me about 3 years to do the course requirements. And then if you wrote a master's thesis, that would replace 9 credit hours. And so Professor Siski offered me an internship over the summer. And I took a leave of absence from ORI and wrote a master's thesis in queuing theory. And then, of course, about that time, I was trying to get a divorce, and my first husband, he didn't really want to get one. And it went to a court, which was denied. Believe me, you could try to get a divorce, and they could tell you, no, you can't get a divorce in this name. So that was a law in the state of Maryland in the 50s. So I had a $66 in child support and a husband that I really didn't want to have anything to do with. And I had another lucky break. Well, it started out badly when I discovered that my roommate at ORI would chat about the work, and he would casually ask me questions about how to do this and that, and I would tell him. And one day he was, somehow I was looking at a proposal or some paperwork, and I realized that he was taking my ideas, selling them to management as his own, and he was getting $10,000 a year, and I was getting $5,000 a year. So I immediately started looking for another job. I thought, this is real crap. And I got offered a job at IBM for $10,000 a year. And I went into the vice president, and I said, well, I'm leaving. I got a job at IBM for twice my salary. And he said, oh, don't do anything. Don't do anything. We'll fix it. I said, well, thanks, but no thanks. All right, so I went to work for IBM.
Was that still in Washington?
It was in Washington at the time. 7979 Wisconsin Avenue. The ground floor had a computer, this IBM 7090. It took up the whole floor. It was vacuum tubes. It was one of the first computers.
I was going to say, were you able to work with computers at the University of Maryland or not? Was this really your first?
In Maryland, there were no computers.
Okay, so this was your first real opportunity.
Right. There were no computing at Maryland. My master's thesis was purely theoretical.
Mm-hmm.
And the computing at ORI was this wind-up calculator. Life was different then. So this is Washington, D.C. My father said to me, you got a job at IBM? He said, you know, they don't hire Jews. And I said, well, that was the old T.J. Watson. This is T.J. Watson's son. And they're different now. All right. So there were four of us in that group that were oddballs that we hung out together. There was me. There was Bill Goodwin, I think his name was, who was about 6'8" and weighed about 900 pounds. That's a slight exaggeration, but he was a very large person. Then there was a Mexican guy who was a very small person. He was about 5 feet tall. And then there was Nate Woodrick, who was black. So we were great buddies. None of us fit in for some other reason or not, but we enjoyed each other's company, and we were treated fairly at IBM. And but the only trouble was, we would go out to lunch and we would take turns picking out the restaurant. And the first time it was my turn to pick out the restaurant, I said, let's go to that hamburger place. And Bill sort of nudged me in the back. He said, we don't go there because they won't serve Nat.
Oh my.
They didn't. In the 50s in Washington, restaurants would routinely turn away black people. But our life at IBM was good, and I had a lucky break then. Just after my lawsuit to get a divorce failed miserably, IBM announced that they were moving us all out to California. Well, what could be better? In California, I could get a divorce on mental cruelty, and this is something that isn't secret, but at Maryland, Richard Siskey was the only probabilist there at the time. And before I took the written exam, the qualifier, and I asked him, have you put some probability questions on it? And he said, well, no, nobody asked me. Well, there were no probability questions, and I failed the exam. So I failed the math exam. And one of the professors said, well, you just failed it by a little bit, and we hope you'll take it again. I'm sure you'll pass it the second time. But anyway, California needed a divorce. I had failed the math exam there, and IBM was offering to move me out to California, and the whole group, so I wouldn't be by myself either. They moved 12 of us, And right near, first we were in the IBM Research Park in Almaden, and then we moved up to Palo Alto. And when I got there, I rediscovered my old pal Priscilla, who had babysat for Jack, my close friend. I'd lost track of her. Her husband had taken a job with IBM out in San Jose. And so I had friends, I had colleagues, and I had an opportunity to go to Stanford to get a PhD on the work-study program. In those days, they had a very generous work-study program. And so for several years, I worked 30 hours a week in IBM. I got paid full-time, and they paid all the tuition.
Oh, my.
Yeah, so it was a good deal.
And you were in on the ground floor in a lot of things at that time, I would think, at IBM Stanford.
Yeah, yeah. It was a very good time. And I did a very interesting piece of work while I was at IBM. We were working on Pioneer 9, one of the first satellites, and not a satellite, it was a satellite orbiter. It had something called an electrostatic analyzer to measure the solar wind. And they were getting very peculiar results. So we were on subcontract to handle the data analysis for this instrument. And the director of that, the principal investigator of that Pioneer 9 project, by the name of John Wolfe. So I was involved in dealing with the data from that. And they were getting these funny pictures. They really didn't know how to interpret them. Well, I sort of understood how that instrument worked. And I was learning something in my multivariate class at Stanford that made me realize that I could visualize why they were getting this screwy data. And I wrote a little routine, and somebody else computed it for me, that showed that if the solar wind was anisotropic, the solar wind is a stream of particles streaming from the sun at high temperatures, and ordinarily particles are in equilibrium and they're vibrating in all different directions, but the solar wind is anisotropic. It has the particle velocity distribution has a long axis and a short axis. That was enough. I visualized that and I saw that was enough to explain the funny results they were getting. So I worked it out and I showed John Wolfe. And he jumped up and down and he said, "Parker's model of the anisotropy and the solar wind." And it was a big moment. And I had an appointment with my thesis advisor, Manny Parson, to talk about my upcoming exam. And I called him up and I said, "Well, I can't come this afternoon. We have to celebrate because we've discovered the anisotropy and the solar wind." And we all went out to this Chez Yvon and it got slightly drank a lot and everything. And it was a big deal. Well, so that work didn't get published for a while. I went to Washington with John Wolfe and I showed my plots and everything at the American Geophysical Union. And must have been about 1966. That was all very exciting, my first taste of science. Then when it came to writing papers, by the time things were getting written up, I was already here. No, I was a postdoc at Stanford at the time then. And I said, "Well, John, what about my name on the papers?" And after I left IBM and became a postdoc at Stanford, he was paying me as a consultant. Mm. And so he said, "You're getting paid as a consultant. You get paid twice as much as my employees." He says, "If you want to be on the papers, you got to come and work for us." So, I mean, that was really improper. He should have put my name on the papers. So my name was never on the papers. But I was part of the discovery of the anisotropy in the solar wind. Was a big deal. He was murdered later, some years later, at a cash machine in Washington, 10 or 12 years after that. Anyway, it was very exciting.
So how long were you a postdoc at Stanford?
Oh, well, because I got my PhD in 1966, and Manny Parson, my thesis advisor, got me a postdoc, and it was a real blessing. I mean, I had been going to school, going to work, looking after my son, and I didn't have a moment to myself for 4 years, and here I had a postdoc. I didn't have to do anything if I didn't want it. And I wrote up my, had plenty of time, I wrote up my thesis, and I got 3 papers out of it.
So is that what made you decide that you wanted to stay in academic life?
Well, by that time, Manny said, well, Grace, we're going to line up an academic job for you. And so in those, you know, the demographics were different then. In 66, I guess that was all the baby boomers were coming back to school. It was sort of a seller's market for people looking for a job in academia. And I had 6 offers. Nobody has it that now. Even the best students don't have that. Mm-hmm. Plus, IBM offered me a job in Yorktown Heights. And Lockheed offered me a job out there in Palo Alto. And the best job offers were here in Purdue. And Purdue was a better offer, actually. But George Box called me up and gave me the business. He was the chair of the department then. And I had visited here. I had visited here the summer before, because actually I was dating a physicist who was here over the summer. I'd come out in the summer, and it was gorgeous here in May. You know, it was so beautiful.
Of course, right.
And I came for a job interview in January. And, you know, it was all snow and ice, and I remember trying to walk down the street in my high heels and everything, and I was oblivious to the weather. I just only remembered how beautiful it was in the spring. So, anyway, I came here in 67, September of 67.
And what was that like? What did you know about Wisconsin? You knew him. But did you know any about the department,
well,
the university?
Well, I didn't actually know George Box personally then.
Oh, okay.
But, I mean, he's still alive, he's retired now. He was one of the leading statisticians of his time. He and John Tukey were the two big famous statisticians. And he was the founder of this department. So, and my thesis advisor's field was time series, same as George Box. So he was very well known in the academic world, and I didn't really know anybody else here. In fact, only a few people here then. I don't remember how many, just a handful. It was a small department. It was only a few years old.
Where was it? Where were you on campus at that time?
Oh, well, we were in they were first in some building on some old building on University Avenue, I came after that. They just moved into the computer science statistics building. So that building has 3 units now. When I came, there was only the first unit. Unit one was completed. Mm-hmm. And basically, Professor Box called up and gave me the business, and Manny Parson said, you can't turn down Madison. And as they say, Purdue offered me more money, but this just looked like I would like it here. And so.
Well, what was it like when you started?
Well, I had a different experience than a lot of women. Everybody was very friendly when I came. And I have to tell you a funny anecdote. So George Chow was another guy who was in Time Series. He left here after a few years and went to Chicago, but he and George Box worked together. Well, Friday nights, the boys or men in the department had a poker game going. And apparently there was some discussion about whether they should invite Grace to the poker game, and the answer was yes. So somebody came up and said, well, we play poker every Friday night, and you're invited as a member of the department. And I lived then, and I still live on Tally Ho Lane, and John Van Ryzen, was it Van Ryzen's house? No, it wasn't his. Somebody, I don't remember who it was. Somebody in the department lived up the street from us. And so I just had to walk up the street to go to the poker game. And I knew how to play 21. That was my idea of poker. Mm-hmm. That's all I knew. Well, so I was, at that time I was, I must have been living with Ray Moore, who became my second husband. And I said, Ray, tell me, you know, I'm going to this poker game on Friday. Tell me how to play poker. And so he was a big poker player. So he says, well, there's this, and there's that, and there's a third thing, and there's this and that. And I said, anyway, I went into the poker game with $5 in one hand, and I didn't have a clue, no clue how to play poker. So the first game, they, you know, I got some cards, and was just looking around to see what everybody else did, and somebody put their $5, somebody put their money out, so I just put my $5 in. So everybody looked at one another like, she must have a great hand or something. And then they turned up the cards, and I didn't have anything. I had no clue. I had nothing. So that my $5 went. And then everybody kept on playing. They realized that I didn't have a clue how to play poker. So I never went to the poker game again. But it was the thought that counted. Right. They invited me, and I was the only woman around for miles, and they invited me to poker game. So there were other things that were different in being a woman. Now, George Box was of the old British school. And in England, whenever there's any social function, the senior lady always sits to the left of the host, the position of honor. Well, so every time we had a speaker, we'd have a speaker, and we'd all sit around a big table at a Chinese restaurant, and I always got to sit next to the speaker. George Box on the right, Grace Wabba, senior lady on the, senior man on the right, senior lady on the left. Now, so here I was, this green assistant professor, and I was the one that got to sit next to the speaker. So it was sort of, it was reverse discrimination. So this went on for years, you know. And, well, I just ate it up,
sure,
you know. So, and I, you know, whenever introductions were made, you know, or anything, they're always done in the, George always did things in the English manner, where the senior lady always comes right after the senior man. So anyway, I liked it here.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk about your research. Has it changed? What did you do in the beginning when you came as an assistant professor? Has it changed?
Well, of course, everything has changed with computers. Everything I do now is very experimental. We think of ideas and we try them out on the computer. Mm. When I first came here, there was a UNIVAC, I think it was called a UNIVAC 1108. It was a big machine. It was on the first floor of the computer science, Unit 1 of Computer Science Statistics Building. At that time, there was a big glass wall there, and you could look in, and you could see the computer, and you could see people running around. Well, when things started heating up around here because of the Vietnam War, the director of the computing center had that wall bricked up, and everybody was kind of pissed off. Who was this guy bricking up that wall? But he was right. Somebody would have thrown a rock through it. So, let's see, think of an anecdote from that time period. We had, I was part-time at the Math Research Center, which gave you some time off. That's the famous Math Research Center that got blown up. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that I did pure research. I didn't do any Army work at that time. Anyway, there were lots of visitors. And one of them was a guy by the name of Svante Vold, a Swede who was visiting here for a year. And there was an open question, well, this will get kind of technical, but there was an open question floating around about choosing the regularization parameter in ill-posed inverse problems. And he and I were sitting next to each other one day in a talk, and somebody was giving a talk about a related topic, and it hit us at the same time how to solve that problem. He was sitting here, I was sitting here. We turned to each other and we said, cross-validation. Well, it turned out that was, turned out to be a good way of doing it. And so we were going to demonstrate that by trying it out on a computer on that 1108. Now, what you had to do then was you wrote your code in Fortran, and then you went down to a computer room and you had these holographic cards, these punch cards, and you punched it in the deck, and you put a rubber band around it, and you wrapped it up with some instructions, and you took it over the desk, and somebody would insert it in the machine and run it. You would come back 2 or 3 days later, and you would get your deck of cards back, and you would get a piece of paper with your output, which said, failed to run. Anyway, it would give an error message. So, but that's the way it was. But eventually, we got the program to run, and it used, at that time, the department had $600 a month to spend on that computer, and it cost $600 an hour. Oh. And we used up the whole year's department allocation of computer money in the space of a couple of days, but we did demonstrate that the idea worked. So that we wrote a big paper about that.
And that was at the beginning of...
That was in, 1975. Well, we did the work about 73. But before that, while I was at Math Research, I had time off to go to Math Research Center. So that was, at that time, that was just a hotbed of numerical analysis, a certain area. And everybody who was anybody would come through. They had a lot of money for visitors. It was really, it was very nice, actually. We had tea in the morning at 11 o'clock, and we talked about splines and other things. And then we had tea in the afternoon, and it was a lot of research went on there. And I found there was another visitor there by the name of George Kimmeldorf, and another one by the name of Zuhair Nashid. Anyway, George and I discovered we had the same idea. We got together and we wrote this paper. And it's called Kimmeldorf and Wab in 1971. And George said, oh, it's pretty trivial. Do you think we should publish it? Or maybe it was me that thought it was too trivial. I thought it was too trivial. Well, anyway, we wrote it up and we sent it in. And it was accepted within 3 weeks, right away. It turned around right away and they said they would publish it. And there wasn't a single critical remark. And I thought, this stuff is a breeze. Well, I've been here 40 years. I have never had a paper that's been accepted within 3 weeks. And I have since then never had another paper that didn't have a single critical referee's remark. Nobody paid too much attention to it until about 8 or 9 years ago. But then there is a... It's a paper, so I'm getting kind of technical now. I don't know how else to do it. But it's a paper that talks about the nature of optimization problems in something called a reproducing kernel Hilbert space, a particular mathematical object, how to solve these problems. And it shows that the certain type of problem has a simple solution if you cast it a certain way. And about 8 or 9 years ago, it was discovered that one of the recent advances in classification methods, a method called a support vector machine, that the support vector machine could be derived as an optimization problem in a reproducing kernel Hilbert space. That is, this 1971 paper showed how you could derive the support vector machine very easily. So all of a sudden, that paper, 1971, became very famous. Anyway, so that's probably the most highly quoted paper I ever wrote. Then later on, I guess in your notes you asked me what were the important things.
Right.
Then the early work with Svante Wold on cross-validation, that got improved about 1979 when I wrote a paper with Gene Gala on something called generalized cross-validation. That's another very famous paper. And so that's probably the next most famous thing I did. And then there's something called spline and ova models, which I did in the late 80s in conjunction with several students, former students who are all professors now, and my colleague Yi Lin, who is on leave here, and I hope he comes back. But now skipping around, there's another story I have to tell you about Gene Gala, who I wrote this paper on generalized cross-validation with in 1979, which is very famous work. Gene was a computer science, or it was and is a computer science professor at Stanford when I was a graduate student. And he was, at Stanford, I really had several mentors, my thesis advisor, Manny Parson, and his wife, Carol. I'm very dear friends with him to this day. And Ingram Olkin, who I was on my committee, and I'm good friends with him to this day. And Gene. And now, Gene was not in the statistics department, and I don't really remember how I met him. But in the 70s, when I was on sabbatical in England, Gene was at Zurich at ETH, Swiss Technical Institute, and he invited me there to give a talk. And another statistician who was a friend of Gene's was at Zurich and owned a house in Clusters, the very ritzy ski resort, and Peter Huber. And Peter invited Gene and I to come up to his house in Clusters for the weekend. And we got on the train, and we thought up generalized cross-validation. We worked out the ideas in that paper on this train to Clusters. It was beautiful. So it's a very famous paper. 2 weeks ago, no, it was last week actually, I just got back from Stanford. Computer science department's having a 75th anniversary birthday party for Gene. And they're having a big festschrift meeting, and they invited all the people who had written famous papers with him, and I was one of them. So I got to give a talk, and they put out a book that reprinted these papers. It has about 25 papers in it, including the one I wrote with Gene. And then they asked us, each of the co-authors, to write how this paper came about. And so I described this journey to Clusters, this trip to Clusters, that was so wonderful. I mean, I still remember, we took the train, but I can see it now. And then we finished at dinner. We had dinner with the Hubers. We drank some wine, and we watched all the skiers come down the mountains from their window. It's really beautiful. And this party that I just returned from, my old mentors, Manny Parson and my thesis advisor and Carol were there. Ingram Olkin was there with his wife, and Ted Anderson, who was in the econ department, who I knew as a student. And there was everybody who was anybody in numerical analysis. I mean, because this Gene Gala was kind of a center of numerical analysis, and so I saw a lot of old friends there. So I've had a lot of nice things happen to me.
Absolutely. Okay. Talk about the tenure process. Did you have problems with the tenure process, or did you just breeze right through?
It was different now. Yeah. Nowadays, well, first of all, we have mentor committees, and then we tell the assistant professors, we interview them, and then we sit down with them, and we tell them how to improve. And to me, it's horrible, because we got four people on that committee, and they have different ideas. They all have different ideas about what you should do. The field is very broad. Some people think you should be very experimental. Other people want to see theorems. A third person wants to make sure that you publish your papers in JASA and the Annals of Statistics. And other people say, well, if you do collaborative work, then you should be publishing in the journals of the science that you're collaborating in. And I don't know, it scares the dickens out of me, because it scares the dickens out of the assistant professors. And we meet every year, we go over it and tell them what's good and bad about themselves and blah, blah. Nobody ever gets tenure before 5 years, and if after 5 years, people start saying, 5 years, that's early tenure. let's wait another year. You know, some people are 7 years before they get tenure. Well, when I came, I was aware that the earliest you could get tenure was 3 years. And I was doing this wonderful stuff, so I expected maybe I'd get promoted after 3 years. Well, I didn't. And I stayed up all night having a bad dream about it. But I got back to work. The next year, I got a letter which said, "Congratulations, we have promoted you to associate professor with tenure." Oh. So that was it.
Do you tell these new assistant professors that story?
No. That was it. I had tenure. That was it.
Do you enjoy teaching, and has your teaching style changed over the years?
Oh, well, yes and no. All right, when I came here, I got all these stories that are coming out.
Good.
First of all, my field was time series. George Box was the world's biggest time series expert. When I came here, before I came, I wrote the associate chair, Don Watts, and I said, well, what will I be teaching? I probably should start preparing for it. And he said, well, don't worry about it. When you get here, we'll talk about it. Well, that's what he said, so I didn't worry about it. Well, when I got here, I was assigned to teach Statistics 224, which is the introductory statistics course for engineers. And it sort of had a syllabus. It had a book and stuff. It was elementary things. And I was assigned to teach, I think it was called 347, time series. But now George Box was teaching another time series course. And I thought, well, I can't teach the same thing as George Box. And to come hear my lectures instead of George's would be ridiculous. So I thought, what could I do that's different than what he did? So his time series was discrete time. Time operates in discrete intervals. So I thought, well, I'll do continuous time. All right. Anyway, I asked Don Watts what I should do. And he says, do whatever you want. And then only one person signed up for my class. Now, well, they let me teach it anyway. One person who became my first PhD student.
Aww.
So I taught the class. Are you kidding? You know, you would not get any kind of a class with less than 8 people, no matter what. You know? So after that, I switched my field from discrete time series, which would have been in competition with George Box, to something different, which was continuous time series. And then, so that was when I first came here, and now backtracking a little bit, once I went to MRC and talked to George Kimmeldorf, I realized that the way to deal with continuous time series was to look to embed it in these reproducing kernel Hilbert spaces, which I had learned from my advisor, Manny Parzon. So I should get back to teaching. You asked me about teaching. So for many years, I taught Engineer Statistics 224, and I taught an advanced course in continuous time series. And that, in those heady days, they let us generate new classes easily, and I generated syllabus for 2 classes, which are on the books today, Statistics 840 and Statistics 860. And they're very different than they were. And I teach them both, 1 year one and 1 year the other. And they're different every year. And they're aimed at students who are trying to get their PhD, and some of them are looking for thesis problems. And the last few weeks of the class, we try to talk about open problems. And in both of those classes, I spent a few weeks giving classical background, which doesn't change from year to year. And then the middle third of the class talks about the present literature in the field, which is growing very quickly now. If you put reproducing kernel Hilbert spaces into Google, you'll get millions of hits. And so that literature is growing, as I say, different every year. And then the last bit of class, the students, I have some of the students give the lectures, and also we talk about open research questions. So those two courses are on the books, but as I say, every year they're different. I haven't taught 224 for a while because somewhere along the line I started being very good at getting grants. And so I've been raising most of my salary in grants, so I've been fortunate in only having to teach one class. The standard teaching load, that's another sore spot about Dean Certain. The department teaching load has been two courses in the fall, two courses, and there's been four courses for a year, ever since I came. And that's not what other statistics departments around the world are doing. Mm. And that's not what other departments in the university are doing either. Mm-hmm. There are very few departments, I don't think any other departments in science have a teaching load like that. Last year, the new dean gave an inch and reduced it from 4 to 3.5, which is very awkward so this means that for somebody who's carrying a full teaching load, they teach 4 courses 1 year and 3 courses the next.
Oh.
Okay, so you can keep track of that. Well, we have people, what about the people who have a 50% appointment in another department? They've got to cycle through 4 years before they get anything out of that. It's a bookkeeping nightmare. And not only that, but if you start buying out, like I do, buying your time out on a grant, you don't get that half a course anyway. But in any case, my work is pretty well funded. And
where do your grants come from?
Well, I have one from NIH, and I have a nice grant from NIH to study eye diseases. I have a grant from a National Science Foundation. These are very hard to get, by the way, really hard, really tough.
And getting harder, I've been told.
Getting harder. And I have a small grant from the Navy to do machine learning. The NIH grant is basically a theoretical research on statistical model building and variable selection, which is kind of a hot topic. And they're not easy, actually. For many years, I had I started having a fairly big grant from NASA, and I was working on numerical weather prediction, which I really loved. And it was joint work with Professor Don Johnson in the meteorology department. But he retired a few years ago, and I still have some connections with the meteorology department. I sit on exams over there, wrote a paper with Steve Ackerman. But the grants in meteorology dried up a few years ago, and so I haven't really been able to support a research assistant to do the meteorology work. So I really like that stuff, but I haven't really done anything in the last couple of years.
Can you pick and choose pretty much then? When there must be people come to you, obviously, and because of your expertise, because it sounds, you're talking about eye disease and meteorology, and kind of, it's all over the map. So how do you decide what you want to work on?
Well, most of them are pretty long term. I've been working with Drs. Ron and Barbara Klein in the ophthalmology department for, I think it's been about 12 or 13 years. I don't remember exactly how it happened, but I somehow became acquainted with them. And they have 3 demographic studies. The one I've been most closely associated with is the Beaver Dam Eye Study. And they have followed a cohort in Beaver Dam since the 80s. And they had tremendous response from the population there. They had just about 95% of the people over age 44, I think it was, at the start of the study, who agreed to be in it. And the idea was to study the prevalence and incidence and of eye diseases and causes that are related to various eye diseases. And it was a demographic study, not a clinical trial. Mm-hmm. And the effects of various treatments and lifestyle factors and so forth. And Dave DeMatz was in at the beginning when they designed that study many years ago, and so was very well designed, and a lot of talented people work on the data collection, and they have excellent data sets there to try out new methods. So we've been using their work to try out various methods, and every once in a while we find something in the data they hadn't seen, and mm-hmm. it gets very exciting. So that's been long term, and then it was long term with Don Johnson. I ran into him by accident when we were both on the divisional committee, which met Saturday mornings back in the 70s, and he was over in meteorology and I was in statistics, and we'd walk back together, talk about our problems. And he had a master's in statistics, so he was very knowledgeable. And he had this problem of estimating divergence and vorticity of wind fields. And I said, I know how to do that. And so we wrote, we had a long collaboration, I wrote a half a dozen papers with him over the years, and that was funded by NASA. So people do come to me, but right now I'm not really terribly interested in taking on any new projects. They're mm-hmm. all big, long-term things. Mm-hmm. Steve Wright in computer science, I've been working with him because he's an optimization guy who knows a lot of mathematical techniques that I need to know, but I don't. I mean, that's his area of expertise, and so we have a couple of papers in the works. And I hope to do more with him because he knows how to do these things on the computer that I don't know how to do. I know how to set up the problem. He knows how to solve it. Mm-hmm. So that's been a nice collaboration. Mm-hmm. I keep my eye out for something that might turn into a thesis problem for one of my students. Mm-hmm. There's a certain amount of serendipity, sort of, being in the right place at the right time and having thought about things, always thinking about what kind of problems you might be able to do, and then when you hear somebody do them, hear somebody that where your solution might work with their problem, then you, get together.
Would you talk about your work with the graduate students? You said your first student in your first class became your first PhD
right.
student.
I know. He told me he's retiring. That blew
my
mind. Well, he got 67. He must have got his PhD in 71, Mark Yang. And his English wasn't very good. My Chinese was non-existent. But we communicated on the blackboard, and he wrote a nice thesis. And he got a position as an assistant professor at the University of Florida in Tallahassee, I think, and he's been there all his life, and he wrote a couple books and published a lot of papers mm-hmm. and had students. And
what about some of the others? Do some stand out in your mind?
Well, I hate to pick any one of them because a lot of them are so good. Mm-hmm. But the most famous one is probably Wing-Hung Wong, who I'd have to look at my computer to see exactly when he got his PhD, but he apparently applied, the story is he applied to Berkeley and they didn't let him in, which was the dumbest thing they ever did. And when he came, it was clear he was pretty much of a genius. And at that time, one of the few women who I knew was also visiting here, an Israeli woman by the name of Nira Din, was here. And the three of us talked a lot about things. And Nira was also a much better mathematician than myself, and so was Wing, for that matter. And he wrote a thesis in optimization with very little input from me, because this guy was brilliant. And let's see, he's moved around many times. I don't remember what his first job was, but he was at Harvard for a while, and now he's on the faculty at Stanford. And come to think of it, I didn't really have a chance. I should have run over. I didn't go over to the statistics building to see him because this meeting with Gene was in computer science. But Wing is at Stanford now, And besides being a famous for his mathematics, he's also gotten into biology, and he has his own wet lab, and he generates his own data to try out his statistical methods on it. And he's very well known, better known than I am. And he's had many more students than I have, and he's had many grand students. And then there's a string of other good students. There's Doug Nitschke, who's a director of the Geophysical Statistics Project at NCAR, and Chung Gu is a full professor at Purdue, and Wing Yudan Wang is a full professor at UC San Diego those 2 years. Who came after that? I don't want to leave anybody out. I've had 29 students, and about half of them are going into the academic world. In 2002, I had two fabulous students, women. Yoon-Kyun Lee, and she is the co-author of something called the Multicategory Support Vector Machine, which is a piece of genius work. And she's at Ohio State now. And Helen Zhang, and she said, and she did a wonderful thesis on variable selection, and she's at NC State now. They're both doing very well. And I had two women before that. I had my first woman student was an Australian woman by the name of Heather Lucas, and her husband was an exploration geologist, and she moved to Baton Rouge, Louisiana with him, and basically dropped out of the academic world for a long time. I just made contact with her recently, and she's teaching at a small school. But, basically she gave up the opportunity to have an academic career in order to follow her husband. The next woman was a Chinese lady about 10 years later by the name of Ji Jin Xiao. And she also had a husband that gave her a hard time about her academic career. She was offered a position at SMU as assistant professor, and he said he was in computer science, and he said he would follow her. But she went there, and he went with her, and then he didn't like SMU, and he left. And I could sort of understand it. She was probably the first woman at SMU, and they were probably the first Chinese that they'd seen there. Mm-hmm. Her husband was a little tiny guy. And anyway, so she left SMU, and she followed him around for a while. And she has a position in Taiwan, and she's doing research. Okay, but you had another woman who was a very good student, whose name I won't give you, who was married to a student in another department, and who I knew, and she was much better than he was. And at some point she just shut down because she didn't want to get ahead of him. Mm-hmm. And so I told her, if you don't get to work, you got to find another thesis advisor, which she did, and she eventually got a PhD, but I don't know. Anyway, Helen and Yoon had supportive husbands. That's what it took. Mm-hmm. So Yoon's husband, I think he probably must be finished by now, but he's working on a PhD in another department here. And he said that he would go to NC State with her so she could, he would go to Ohio State with her so she could take up this job, and he would finish his PhD long distance. Helen had a very close call. She gave a talk at a meeting, and somebody from Rensselaer Polytech, which is a very prestigious engineering school, talked to her, and they offered her the world to go to RPI. Mm. She was very smart. They offered her a big salary, lots of perks, the whole works. But then her husband was in cancer research. RPI is in Troy, New York. There was nothing for him within 200 miles. So she said that she was going to follow him and just take a job in a pharmaceutical company. I thought that would be a big loss. Well, then she got an offer from NC State, and Research Triangle Park has plenty of opportunities, so her husband agreed to search for something there, and he found something suitable for him at NC State. So there, I just got a letter asking me to write in support of putting her up for some kind of prize. I don't know. Anyway, they've both been there 2002. I guess they'll both be up for 10 years soon. I'm sure they'll get it. So times have changed, and I'm very happy to see them. They're doing really well. I look at their websites, and they got all this wonderful research, and that's nice.
What is the national and the international reputation of the statistics department here?
Well, we always like to think that we're pretty good. Doesn't everybody? When I first came here, we were undisputably number three or number four after Stanford, Berkeley, and Chicago. We were definitely right up there. Now, we're still up there, except that there are a few other schools like Ohio State, NC State, and Ohio State that are coming along. So we have a lot of competition for position number four, I would say. Mm-hmm. But it's considered a pretty good department. But the dean is not, I mean, the present dean, maybe he's trying to help, but these digs don't help. Yeah. I mean, people, couple years ago, we had two positions to fill, and we interviewed four people, and they didn't come here. Hmm. The salaries here are not that great. And, I mean, they come here in the winter and see this building that's too cold in one part of the building too cold, the other part's too hot. I don't know. And then the domestic partner health benefits, the lack of that, that riles some people,
sure.
including myself. Well, I have a domestic partner. Mm-hmm. It's a man, but he has just run out of health benefits. And so we are paying $7,000 a year for his health benefits. Now, the guy in the next room who's doing the same work that I am gets the same pay, but he has a wife. He's got the family plan.
Yeah.
Now, that's not equal pay for equal work.
Right.
How can they? That's violating the law. What happened to equal pay for equal work? Anyway, the university is trying. Mm-hmm. The governor is trying, too, but it's probably not going to, it might get, who knows what's going to happen.
Well, I hope someday, but sooner rather than later. We'll jump a little bit here. You mentioned earlier that you were on the divisional committee. I would imagine you've been tapped for a lot of extracurricular activities on campus. Would you talk about some of them, some of the ones that you enjoyed, if there is such a thing, and some of them that you would never do again?
Well, I've been tapped for all kinds. I'm always asked to be on committees. And when I first came here, not first came here, but I've been here about 10 years, there's all this move to get, be fair to women. Let's have some, women should be on these committees and everything. And, all of a sudden I found like I'm being asked to be on everything. Well, when I first came here, I was on the Space and Remodeling Policies Committee. It was pretty interesting as an assistant professor to see how the university works. There's, spare you some stories about that. Well, here's one story. That Humanities Building, or was just built at the time. Okay, I taught in there once. You open a door, and the wind would blow the papers off your desk. Well, the contractor did not balance the heating system. What you have to do, apparently, is you have to go around with two or four men, or women, whoever. I mean, it was only men then, and adjust the louvers and the vents and everything so that the heat doesn't rush between rooms. Well, the contractor had left without doing it. So the Space and Remodeling Policy Committee had a proposal from somebody from the Humanities Building. They wanted $15,000 to hire people to do it. And I said, well, it's in the why doesn't the contractor do it? It's in the contract. And they said, well, it's more trouble than it's worth trying to get the contractor to do it. Anyway. And then there was another thing I had there. There was a proposal from the engineering school for air conditioning for a room for computers. They wrote a beautiful proposal, explained exactly why you need it. No sweat. Then there was a proposal from the dance department. They needed a new floor. Well, the women in the dance department, they had no idea how to write a proposal.
Oh, dear.
They said, please give us X dollars because we need a new floor. Well, the committee looked and said, what kind of proposal is this? So I said, come on, guys. They're not used to writing proposals. I said, the guys in engineering write proposals all the time. The dance department has no way of getting money anywhere, you know. And so I think they got their floor, but I don't remember the details. All I remember is they didn't know how to write a proposal, and the committee didn't want to give them any money because they said, please give us some money, we need it. And that's all, that was the proposal. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Do you think anybody would have read it anyway?
I don't know. I was the only woman on the committee, yeah. And nobody knew anything about dance.
Floors?
They didn't have a clue that dancers need the right kind of floor. Mm-hmm. They're going to ruin their feet.
Sure.
I guess nobody on that committee understood that, except me. I'd taken dance lessons. I knew the floor was important.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was on the divisional committee for several years. And I've been on a few committees here and there. But I've tried to... I've been in the Senate, but I try to avoid.
Well, did you ever have to chair the department?
Well, they tried to get me to stand, but I wouldn't do it. I don't feel that that's my talent.
Mm-hmm.
Several times I've been asked to stand for president of the Institute of Math Stat, but I figured I'm not cut out to be an administrator. I mean. I'm just not good at that. Figure other people are better. I go to Washington about 3 or 4 times a year because when you get grants, they expect you to review other grants. And on Monday, I'm on a proposal panel. I told them I just couldn't come to Washington again now, and I'm going to do it over the phone. There'll be a board meeting to review proposals, and then I'll be teleconferenced into it. But I was in Washington a couple months ago on a review panel for graduate fellowships at NIH, at NSF. So I do a lot of that, and I figure that's my share. And then there's the usual department committee work, which is shared around, and that's not my favorite thing to do, but that's, you know, I try to do my share.
Mm-hmm. Would you mentioned when you first came here that you were invited to the poker party, and so I'm assuming that the culture of the statistics department is quite good for women, woman for a while?
Right, yes, and yeah, I mean, that was good for me, mm-hmm. Okay. Then, there was another woman here, Sue Largens, and she left in her sixth year, and she should have gotten tenure. And I was in Australia at the time, and in those days, getting letters back and forth from Australia took 3 weeks, and we had some department regulations about voting by proxy or when you're away and everything. And I wanted to vote that she should have gotten tenure at that time. And I never got the message. I never got the information in Australia. This was in the 70s, I guess. Phone calls. I was basically out of communication from the department then. That's the way it was. And when I got here, I guess they didn't give her tenure in her sixth year, and she left.
Mm-hmm.
Then a few years later, the department interviewed a lot of women, and over the years, and none of them came here for various reasons. Then Bin Yu came, who came for a few years, and I was very glad to see another woman who looked like she was going to stay here and B, get tenure. She's a very smart woman. And Donna Shalala was chancellor at the time, and Donna pulled a few strings, and her husband was an architect, and he pulled a few strings around to get her interviews, and her husband got a job with Kent and Peters, and they bought a house. So I thought we were all set, but she was a student at Berkeley, and they made her a better offer, and she went back to Berkeley. She's a full professor there.
Mm-hmm.
So then she was only here a few years. But then a few years ago, now we have 4 other women. let's see, I'll get their Chinese names mixed up. But to make a long story short, one of them is Sundas Kellis, who's, you know, there are four women. None of them did their undergraduate work here in the United States, by the way. Jun Xu is Chinese. Cecile Anne is French. And Sundas is Turkish. And so there's no, I'm a rare bird, an American woman who got an undergraduate degree in the United States. Uh-huh. Anyway, Sundas is a brilliant woman, and we work together. We've been working together for a while. Uh-huh. And climate is the people involved. And they can be, you know, if you have one rotten apple, it can really stink the place up. But I've been very happy here. The department's been really good to me. Now, I spent 2 years at Yale, and this is when I first met David, the man I live with now. He was at Bridgeport, and I had a sabbatical coming up, and so I was looking to go be near him. And I realized that Yale and University of Bridgeport were in commuting distance, and so I contacted I.R. Savage, who passed away now. He's a well-known statistician who was chair at Yale at the time. And he got me a Clara Booth Luce Fellowship for 2 years. So I went. Well, so Professor Savage was very good to me. There's another person who anybody will recognize, but I'm not going to mention his name, who was the alpha male there, who was just very dismissive. He just took down to me. I don't want to say too much. All I can say is, after I got back here, somebody wrote me and said, I've been invited to go to Yale. My husband's going there. I said, don't go. Do not go to Yale. Professor Savage was very good to me. The department only had three people there at the time. Mm-hmm. And this alpha male was, as I say, made it very unpleasant. And the atmosphere at Yale, Professor Savage had tried to get me into a college, and apparently it was very hard to do, but he finally got me into Timothy Dwight. So Yale has this wonderful college system. The school is loaded with money, okay? So the college is Timothy Dwight. Every month they had they would have a social, and they would invite famous people to come and give a talk. Mario Vargas Llosa, Pat Schroeder, Qureshi, what's his first name? The guy who wrote Sammy and Rosie, can't remember his name now. Famous, well-known people. So you would go there, and there would be a sort of a cocktail party, and then some kind of entertainment and a banquet. Well, so Timothy Dwight had three or four women. There's a black woman from Nigeria who kept to herself, and there was a woman, there were several women in, I think it was some arts division, and I was talking to them, and I was asking them, is this whole place really as sexist as I think it is? And they said, you know, the only women in Yale are concentrated in a very small number of departments, art history, I can't remember what it was, but she said, other than that, there are really no women here. And they were all pissed off, all of them. They hated it. And so I had this Clara Booth Luce Fellowship. There was another woman who had been in the music department, who had been there 10 years in the music department, and then had been denied tenure. And she was on leave to someplace else, but she came back to Yale for some kind of interview, and I was talking to her. And she was suing. She had a lawsuit against the department. Well, life there was extremely unpleasant in some aspects. And one time I remember in particular, I took David, we were going to hear, there was some famous speaker, right? Maybe it was Mario Vargas Llosa, I can't remember. anyway, I took David to this cocktail party. And I'm a pretty gregarious person. And so I would walk up to see some guys at a meeting. Well, I'm Grace Wobb. I'm in the statistics department. Who are you? What do you do? All right. So, but I was standing there next to David, who had his best suit on. And three men walked up, very charming. And they said, hello, we're so-and-so and so-and-so. I'm from which department? Or who are you? And he said, well, I'm Dave Callen. I'm with her. She's the Claire Booth Luce Professor of Statistics. Those guys turned around and walked away. I kid you not.
Wow.
That was Timothy Dwight. Anyway, I kept telling myself not to pop off about it. But, you know, I still remember it.
Sure.
So I had friends in the computer science department. So I went over, David Rockland, Vladimir Rockland, and some other people. They got me a login on the computer science computers, and I would join those guys for lunch when it became just too unpleasant to eat lunch with alpha male. I would go over there. And I was invited to talk at the economics department. I got a nice welcome. And I went over and I talked to George Veronis in the atmospheric and ocean sciences department. He was very nice. And I realized that there's some pockets in Yale that were very bad. And there was a Christmas party in our department where alpha male handed out a flyer of jokes. And one of the jokes was, a man is only as old as the woman he feels. That was the first and only time I said, David, I am not staying one more minute in this department. We are leaving. That was only 1 out of 10. Anyway, I was glad to get back here.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't offer me a position, and if they had, I would have told them where to put it. So, anyway, now I think this person has retired, and I.R. Savage, I think he's passed away now. He was very nice, but he was very disabled, and he really couldn't do anything. The other guy pushed him around a little bit. I think it's a different department now that people have turned over. But I never saw anything like that here. My department was very nice to me. So.
Well, let's switch directions then. You talked a little bit about your involvement in professional organizations. Would you talk more about that? What are some of the professional organizations that you're involved with, and are they important to your career?
Oh, yeah, they all are. Well, I'm a fellow of every department. I mean, every society you can think of. No, I mean, the two big statistics societies are the Institute of Math Stat and the American Statistical Association. And I've given invited lectures there many times at their meetings, and especially at the Institute of Math Stat. I gave what's called the World Lectures. They're 3 one-hour lectures at the annual meeting. That was 3 or 4 years ago in San Francisco. And so that was a big deal. That's the biggest honor they can give you. And so I was, of course, thrilled, and I told some of my students about it. And a whole bunch of my students came back, and they gave me a surprise Chinese banquet.
Oh,
it was so wonderful. There were almost, about two-thirds of my students were there, and they kept it a big secret. Doug Nitschke wrote me a couple months ahead of time and said, Bernie Silverman and I want to have dinner with you on Monday night. Can you do that? And I said, sure, I'll save Monday. It'll be wonderful to see you guys. Then when I got there, something else came up, and I said, can we switch from Monday to Tuesday? And he said, well, we can't really. And I thought, well, that's kind of peculiar. I mean, Doug has never been sort of this rigid before, but anyway. All right. So Doug came to get me at the hotel, and we were walking up. We were supposed to meet at some Chinese restaurant in San Francisco. And David was there the other way. And I said, what are you doing up here? And he says, oh, I'm just out for a walk. So Doug Nitschke and I and David walk into this Chinese restaurant, and he said, let's go upstairs. And then I knew something was up. And I got up there, and there's like 12 or 15 of my students, and their students were there. And it was a big, wonderful banquet.
Would you talk about honors and awards that you've received?
Yeah, well, I've got them all somehow. So I became a fellow of the Institute of Mass Stat in the 70s. And then I became a fellow of the American Statistical Association a few years later. And then I got this letter, I think it was around 97, where I got this letter that said, you have been elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and please send $110. And I thought, what is this nonsense? But somehow I showed it to somebody, and I said, Grace, that's a big honor. So I sent him the $110. David and I went to the inaugural ceremony.
What was that like?
That was a big deal. Shirley Abramson was elected at the same time.
Oh my.
And I met her. That was a thrill. I knew her husband, Seymour Abramson, was in the zoology department, and I used to know him when I was figure skating. So I knew him, and of course, he introduced me to Mrs. Abramson, the Chief Justice of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, who is an extremely talented and gracious woman. And so there are the American Academy inducts people from academia as well as famous people from the arts and entertainment and so forth. So that was a big deal. Then one morning in 2002, I got a phone call at home about 8 o'clock in the morning, and Carl DeBoer was on the line, and I said, Carl, what's a big idea? I'm just still asleep. And he said, you've just been elected to the National Academy of Sciences.
Wow.
So that was, of course, that's the biggest deal of all. Yeah. And so we went to that.
David, what was that like?
Well, it's a big ceremony. They have a big building in Washington. You see a lot of famous people. I saw Maxine Singer from my other life. Maxine Singer is a very famous biochemist who was head of the Carnegie Institute for many years. She's a very renowned scientist and administrator at the Carnegie Institute. She was a postdoc at NIH when my first husband was there, and I had still remembered she had invited us over for a dinner at her house. And I remembered that because I had a baby and I was sort of at home trying to keep things together. Well, she had a baby. She had a postdoc at NIH and was doing work there that was to become, that was, everybody agreed, was very famous. And she was a fabulous cook, and she made this fabulous dinner, and I thought, oh God, how does anybody do that? Anyway, I didn't see her after that, but I met her again at the inauguration.
Did you tell her that?
Yeah, I told her that I remembered the dinner at her house, which had been 50 years ago, really. Anyway, she was also very charming, a very lovely person.
That's amazing.
I have a lot of fun memories of all these people. Mm-hmm.
Well, then our last two questions have to do with life after work. If you would talk about your family, how you balance work and family.
Life after work. Who has any life after work in this business?
And when you're not working, if there ever is that time, what do you do for fun and relaxation?
I met David Callan, who's a mathematician. He's quite a bit younger than I am. I met him here on the dance floor about 21 or 22 years ago. And we've been living together for a long time. And we are engaged, and we have been engaged for a long time, and we will get married one of these days.
When you have time.
when we have time, yeah. So, at that time I was single. I've been single for a long time, and I thought, I want to meet a man who likes to dance, and that was David. And so he was a very accomplished folk dancer. And I had always enjoyed folk dancing and also ballroom dancing. I met him at a ballroom dance studio. So we usually go ballroom dancing once a week. And he folk dances, and sometimes I go. There's a folk dance group that meets here. Mike Uharski, who was a math TA when I was on the faculty here. Anyway, I've known Mike for 30 years, 40 years. David has also known Mike, but my friend has been running this folk dance group. So we go to that once in a while, and we go ballroom dancing almost every Friday. And
where do you go?
Well, there's something called Friday Night Ballroom. Oh. It's sort of an ad hoc group that it's sort of been falling apart the last few months. I hope it gets its act together. But anyway, they have people take turns being DJs. They usually have a ballroom dance class, a 1 hour lesson ahead of time. And then it's just very informal dancing. It's now held over an old town in a remodeled apartment that somebody has fixed up the second floor as a dance floor. Huh. And it's a lot of fun. We just dance. We do swing, we do Latin, we do folk dance. We do the polka. David's really good at the polka. And it's a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. We've taken a few waltz lessons and do fancy turns and bicycle riding. And so when the weather's good, we take our bikes out on Sundays. And when there's snow, we go cross-country skiing. Of course, the cross-country skiing is dwindled down to almost nothing. Mm-hmm. But we go up north every winter during the break. And we did find snow this winter in Ironwood, even though there wasn't much snow anyplace else. Mm-hmm. We had a wonderful 4 days of skiing.
I know you have one son.
Yeah. Well, he's a chief financial officer for a large company out on the West Coast. Makes a lot more money than his old lady, that's for sure. And then they have three children. The oldest is a sophomore at Occidental College. And then the twins, a boy and a girl twins, are in the 11th grade. And the girls, tennis has always run in our family, although I don't play anymore. But my father was a high-ranked amateur tennis player, mm-hmm. and my son played college tennis when he was at Cornell, but when he went to, then he transferred to Stanford, he wasn't good enough for the Stanford team, which was the national team, but he's always played tennis. And the girls are very serious tennis players, they both have national rankings.
Oh my goodness.
And I love to follow them on the web, where you put in their names and you see, especially, Jennifer, the oldest, is playing on the Occidental team. It's a Division III team. And I think she's the number one player on the team. And Allison is playing in the 18s now, although she's only 17. And she's a real power. She's a little kid, but she's about my size, which is small for California tennis players. But she's really good. So.
Do you think they'll try to go professional?
Well, no, I don't. Well, Jennifer, no, she's not really working at it. I don't know about Allie. I think the ones that are going to go professional probably are ranked in the top 20 or something. Mm-hmm. I think her ranking is about 200. But, I think she won the Hawaii State Tournament. So they play a lot.
Yeah.
It's fun to watch.
Well, we're at the end of the questions, but I don't want to turn the tape off if there are some things that we haven't covered that you would like to have recorded.
Oh, well, I don't really know. I must say the best part of it all has been the wonderful students. I've had all these terrific PhD students. My most recent one is a guy named John Carew, actually one of the few students I've had that actually went through, got his undergraduate degree here in Wisconsin, and he went to the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory and a very nice job as assistant professor. So he just graduated. That was the most recent one. And then I have four students now coming up, and they're all doing nice work.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the best part of it.
Well, thank you very much for agreeing to be interviewed. This was just excellent. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's sort of fun, you know.
I hope so.